I love all the stickers in here. Like LMB.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Mysterioso theme. I was out all day with my guest here. We were up in Santa Barbara trying to get a paraglider flight for her, but it didn't work out. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It was fun anyway.
The guest today, which I didn't have a chance to announce because we just thought of it today, I think. Or was it last night?
Today.
Yeah. Is Sheikah Bruce, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some of you who are listening, the regular listeners, may know who she is. Probably best known for... What do you think you're best known for? Not the Montauk books.
No, I think I'm best known for those disinformation pilots that I was in that had to do with Montauk, yeah.
Oh, okay. And also as a little-known... as a well-known guest on a little-known show that I worked on called Conspiracy Zone, which is probably one of the only times I've seen you besides twice in the last year, I think.
Right.
Because she's been living here in Los Angeles. And I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to announce the show because she has been blowing my mind all day with various commentary on all kinds of stuff germane to what goes on in this program and on UFO Mystic, etc., mainly about the merging of different disciplines of science and how science has to evolve to include some of the things that it just doesn't want to look at right now, namely the stuff we talk about on the show, paranormal stuff, UFOs, but it goes so much further than that. How do you start off an interview like this? How did you have fun today?
I had a wonderful time. It was great to lie down on the grass and look at the ocean. And
get a horrible sunburn?
Yeah, I got
it. Are you going to be okay?
Yeah, I get burnt and it turns tan eventually.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we were out trying to fly. I flew a little bit paragliding, and she could just basically sat on the grass and was patient while I flew and got my feet off the ground. Which is very nice of her, because I called my wife, and she said, boring. because she's had to do that. Every time she sees, hears I'm going flying, she goes, oh, okay, I got stuff to do. Even if it's just sitting at home. However, you will not be in the L.A. area much longer, probably.
Well, yeah, I don't think so, unless something completely different happens. But
you have to get closer to the microphone, I'm sorry to say.
Hey.
There, see? So I thought, while we were driving today, I said, I got to do my show. Hey, you want to come on the show tonight? And she said, yeah, sure. And we'll probably ramble all over the place. One, since I didn't have a chance to write up any questions, I usually write up like 20 questions. And then I almost never get through all of them. Mm-hmm. But, at the Retro UFO conference, the last one, last year, Chica came and talked about our UFO sightings. I guess we can talk about something mundane like that. You don't have to list what happened unless you want to, but more like,
I've just spoken
about
it.
Did it affect you? Does it change anything that you think about the way things are put together, our universe and our place in it?
Completely.
Really?
What it did, when I was 13 years old, when I had a major sighting, I had just moved from Chicago to São Paulo, Brazil, which at the time had, I think, a population of 15 million people then. It probably has much more now. And the fact that it wasn't front page news or on TV, and the fact of what it was doing, it was propulsion, it was anti-gravity propulsion that was inaudible without any, you know, jets or chopper blades. It was breaking all the rules of physics, and it wasn't on the front page news. And it was over one of the biggest cities in the planet. So right there and then, what that told me was that there was a maybe everything was a lie. That's really what I got from that experience, is that everything, if that could be happening and not be news, then everything else must be a lie too. You know, everything is a lie. We're living in a humongous tapestry of lies. That's what I got.
And there's been nothing to dissuade you from that since then?
Well, that other people...
Not that I don't disagree with you.
Yeah, no. What... Nothing has dissuaded me from that except for that other people have had similar experiences, so I know that there's another truth out there that's not the one that is the mainstream truth.
Yeah, well, what...
I don't know what it is,
though. Huge question. Yeah. What would that include, maybe?
Well, obviously other means of propulsion than jet and chopper blade kind.
Right.
And I couldn't... Really, our first... I was with my neighbor, a Brazilian girl, who was quite... She was in her early 20s. I was 13. I was giving her tap dancing lessons, and then we were... It was hot. It's Brazil, so we were cooling off, and it was going to be dinner time any moment. And the sky was dark, and it was before 7 o'clock because the tropics and sunsets early... And I've never heard any other description of something like what I saw, but our first reaction was that it's the Russians or it's the Americans. We didn't jump to like it's the aliens at all. We were like, this is some secret technology that humans have, because it didn't look like anything. It looked like it was made out of mundane rebar-ish kind of looking.
It
was a giant flashlight shaped object that looked like it had what now is very common but wasn't then, a satellite dish on one end of it. It sort of looked like a Skylab situation. But it had like a superstructure of an exoskeletal superstructure on it.
Right.
And it had rows of red lights like you see on a radio tower, and a bright white light at the center of the satellite dish. It looked like a very mundane, like right now, it would look like a very low-tech sort of... There's nothing plasmic or interdimensional or ghostly or strange about it. It looked like a totally three-dimensional thing. We went, got binoculars, and all it did was amplify what we were seeing with our naked eyes. It was a very 3D solid object. It took...
That sounds like something really atypical to be seeing not like there aren't atypical things seen in the skies.
Oh, I've seen those too. But yeah. This was my first one.
Yeah.
And
it just sounds like something completely not that's not supposed to be in the air. It doesn't look like a flying saucer or a balloon or
right.
anything you'd expect, aerodynamic, anything like that.
No,
it looks
exactly.
like a not thing made out of girders floating in the
right,
sky.
Exactly. Floating without any sound at all. And it came from the edge of the atmosphere. It was a red dot over our heads. And I thought, wow, maybe we're seeing a supernova. Maybe we're sort of like those amateur astronomers that discover things before other guys do sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's what I really thought until it kept getting larger and larger and the shape began to distinguish itself. And without really knowing what I was looking at, and the fact that it made no sound, it's hard to say exactly what the distance was, but I would gauge roughly 2,000 feet
right.
in the air. And maybe the size of a 747 or-ish, you know.
You didn't have anything to compare it
yeah,
to, though.
Yeah, exactly.
So it could have been 100 feet, well, not 100, it could have been like a few hundred feet over you, or it could have been a few thousand feet.
It sort of looked like it was in the path where to the airport called Congonhas, where there was actually a crash, I think, 2 years ago, because they actually ran service, a certain airline, which will remain unnamed, ran service before they had actually finished paving the strip, before they put those
lights?
No. You know how they make that, the grooves in it to make it less slippery?
Oh, yeah.
So it was a rainy night, and the airplane slipped into a residential neighborhood because the city's grown around this airport, and it's being used less now, but it was in heavy use in the 80s. And we used to take it all the time. Congonhas is, you know, it's where you take the shuttle to Rio. The shuttle that lands in the middle of Rio right in front of the Sugarloaf. And my grandfather lived there, so we would take that all the time. So this was right in the exactly in the landing pattern of where airplanes were landing all day long, and it was right in the middle of it, and I think it diverted traffic. I wouldn't be surprised if it did, and there have been other reports of this in O'Hare recently. It was like a New Year's Day story, I think 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
The first day of 2008, I think, was, or maybe 2009.
Which one?
The one about O'Hare, where a bunch of workers.
Oh, yes. Well, it happened in November, but it wasn't announced till the new
right.
year of 2008.
Right. And it was like, this is a weird way to kick the year off.
Yeah.
It was a very weird announcement. Because, yes, it had happened some 10 weeks prior to the actual front page news appearance.
But the authorities at the airport only somehow announced or leaked out the first of the year.
Right.
And became a big thing. Everybody's wondering what was going on. It was debunked. It was supported. Eventually, Bernard Haish, who runs, God, I can't remember the name of it, but it's a group of civilian pilots, I believe, and scientists that look into strange sightings, especially by pilots, did something like a 40-page paper on it, looking at the weather, different viewpoints, who saw it, what time they saw it, the shape, if it could be explained. The thing is, they were looking for a mundane explanation, and they couldn't find one. So they just said, it's unknown, we don't know what it was.
Oh, really? That's very interesting, because I think that they did try to say that it was maybe just a weird cloud formation first.
Yeah.
But I think O'Hare has been called, it has been at some time in its life, the busiest airport in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to fly out of there a lot.
It's a hub.
Yeah, in my childhood, so I know that place. And I think in Mexico City, they report similar things with the UFOs blocking the landing.
The approach
yeah.
and departure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mexico City. So, and my parents lived there, too, and I saw them there, too. When the whole country didn't, it was actually... It was a nightly news story. It was front page news and totally not debunked and totally like everyone's seeing this and this is true. So it was a very different approach to the story in Mexico than it was in Brazil earlier, like 10 years earlier. So
right. Do you think there might have been some cultural imperialism that kept that, or some sort of worldwide attitude going on in Brazil that kept that from being
I think so.
Reported like it was in Mexico in the
yeah,
90s?
I do think so, yeah. probably. Yeah. And I think that whatever that was has shifted in Brazil, and that there was even a, I'm not a ufologist. I'm just a person who happens to look up and see a lot of things all the time. Not all the time. The last one.
But you have.
I have, like 20 something times. But I have. I'm not really. I don't need to be a ufologist because I see them.
It's a stupid term.
It is.
I hate it when people say this is. We're talking with ufologist Greg Bishop. I go.
It's terrible.
I don't study UFOs. I don't want to be lumped in with those people.
Please, I know. It's just, please.
It's a non-term to me.
Good.
Anyway, what did the thing do? I mean, I remember you telling the story. You said after a while you just went inside.
Yeah, I just
it's one of the weird things that happens in sightings. It's like, how could you go inside with this thing going on?
Okay, I'll tell it for the bazillionth time. Here we go.
Okay, bazillionth time. You know what? I haven't heard you tell it in a while. I think you told it on Adam Gorightly's.
I did, and then I told it a couple weeks ago on Paul Richard Price.
I'm sorry. Do you not want to tell it again? Because if you don't, then don't.
I've already told it.
Okay, then don't tell it
I've
again.
I've already told
No, don't tell it again.
Whatever. That's only that one. That's the first one. And then I have seen weird plasmic things that are more... Then I've seen that on Pravda. They describe, like, weird, almost like amoebic, manta ray-shaped things that really... This thing looked like it lived there. It was like, oh, my God, what am I looking at? This is the craziest
Where
thing.
Where was that?
That was in Vermont.
Oh.
And that
How long
was
ago?
When that was about 15 years ago, and that was with two other people. And actually, one person had their eyes closed and wouldn't look. And the other person saw the same thing I saw.
Miles Lewis.
Oh, that. Okay, well...
Get her to recount the dark sexual Buddhism stuff she spoke about on Untamed Dimensions, but which didn't get recorded because of technical difficulties.
Oh, okay. That was the first... That was Adam Gorightly's first show. And I was just talking about a website that I had run across. And I think it's... maybe if you look up, I think it's called, anyway, it was a translation of a German book, like a 500-page German book that's talking about the seamy underbelly of Tibetan Buddhism and Lamaism. And there's only one other person who's really come out about that, and she's a Scottish professor now, and she was a concubine for a monk for... couple of decades, and then just was like, "This is, I can't believe the mendacity of this whole situation." You know, like this is, I can't live with this. And she went back to Scotland from Tibet and became a professor.
I'd like to hear about that because that it's a heretical thing to say.
Well, she says that there's an esoteric Buddhism where they you know live a more normal life, and the exoteric, which is really it's more of an ideal, just. And my mother tells me, well, come on, everybody knows that the priest, you know, every village in Brazil knows that the priest has a whole family and a lover and a family and children. And
yeah.
It's just known in Brazil. Everyone knows that. There's nothing esoteric about it. So.
But what I meant by heretical was that these spiritually advanced, wonderful, oppressed, and I'm not arguing with that, Tibetan Buddhists are suddenly being portrayed as normal sex-crazed.
Well, this is not even that normal because I think she says that he was in his early 70s and she was in her late 20s at that point. But
well, maybe that's normal there.
But I'm forgetting what her name was. I think her name is June or Jane Campbell or something like that. You could just Google her and... She's a professor. She wrote a whole book about it. But that's that book. The book I was talking about was this like 500-page brick that was translated from German into English around 2006, I believe. And they had a website about it. And they were talking about how these lamas who reincarnate into supposedly like the Dalai Lama's a reincarnation, and they find him. You know, they go search around all these countries to find the child who is the embodiment of this.
Whatever the next Dalai Lama should be, yeah.
Right, and he's even himself said that he's probably the last one because he's done what that being needs to do. But what this book was saying was, and I'm not endorsing it, I'm just recounting what the book was saying, that's all. I'm not in any way not highly knowledgeable of Buddhism, or, and I have no criticism of Buddhism. It seems actually very wonderful. It seems about as close to the truth in many ways as any philosophy is.
Or, yeah, well, a way to live without having to be freaking out.
Right.
Or be under somebody's thumb or control or whatever, apparently.
Well, what this book was saying is that basically what the Dalai Lama and many of these reincarnated lamas, and what the lamaseries function as, is that they harvest and use the communal, the souls of the monks who are deleting their egos and allowing them to almost vampirize their spiritual force and to amplify their own spiritual force.
I see.
By using harvesting the energy of the souls of the other priests, and not only them, but maybe anyone who just believes in them. And that was the dark. That's what this book was all about. But going into very obvious German detail, because it was 500 pages long, and you can find it. It's something like the what's it called? Something like the it talks about
the flapping.
The robes of something, the robes of power, or something like that.
Yeah. Well, when was the book written originally?
I think it had been written originally in the maybe mid or late 90s.
That late?
Yeah.
Huh. Because you would think that was just some part of that whole Nazi incursion into Tibet in the 30s, trying to figure out what the hell was going on there, and the Aryan roots of whatever the hell their religion was. Not necessarily Buddhism, but the other religion in Tibet, which I can't remember, Po or something?
Bon,
that's it. Religion. And trying to figure out how they could use that, or how they could be related to it, or whatever. But this sounds like something totally different.
Well,
obviously, if it came out in the 90s.
It's something that it became very clear to me. I mean, it's just true. The more that it's consciousness energy is what it is. And the more you get more people to believe a certain thing, the more real it actually occurs. And that's what mass consciousness is. And it's important. How we focus our thoughts and what we believe, it actually does matter. It matters, and so that's why it is important that positive thinking. Not to be in denial of things. I think you have to be honest about things and then make things better.
So I told you about this earlier about reading Robert Anton Wilson. When I thought I was going to kill myself, and then later admitting to him, like 10 years later, 15 years later, that he probably kept me from killing myself. But the thing was, like you just said, it's not, you know, don't deny the either side, but acknowledge it and write yourself a script that has you doing as well as you possibly can, or than you think you can.
Right.
And that's a principle of a lot of a lot of esoteric religious practice. Most obviously, I guess.
Well, it's also just the American way, too.
Yeah, visualization. And
Which I talk about in Beyond the Secret. I mean, that's what The Secret is about, as if it was a secret. No, this is how America...
It's not a secret. But it's not a secret. But the thing is, people don't use it a lot.
That's true. People seem to prefer to be victims a lot.
Yeah, well, it's easier.
Yeah.
You know how much easier it is to be a victim and have somebody else do your thinking for you and not have to do anything? It's, God damn it, it's easy. I love it.
That's so true.
But I have to, you have to fight it. Otherwise, and then you get to the point, you've been working at the same job for 30 or 40 years or whatever the hell it is, and you do the David Byrne, you know,
this is not my house. Yeah, what have I done?
Yeah, we seem to be feeding back.
I know.
What
I think
is
you
that?
Should. Oh, maybe I should turn my mic this way. Wait, is it the speaker? Yeah.
Oh, it might that be. Yeah, my. Oh, there we go. It's slightly less in the field.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff we were talking about today, I thought was, hey, look, Stanton Friedman's online.
Hi.
Some of the stuff we were talking about today was you know, I understood probably, you know, 75 to 80% of what you were talking about. One, because I'm stupid, and two, because you speak very quickly. But I thought the stuff that really...
No, you're not stupid.
Okay, well, the stuff that... Thank you. The stuff that really intrigued me was this kind of unified field thing you had about why don't we teach people that in some way make it clear that, and if I'm misquoting you, please tell me, make it clear that looking at things in this separate Aristotelian kind of 19th century way is, and having that taught in schools and having that put on TV and all that, is stopping evolution and stopping evolution of thought, actually.
Yep.
And you had an idea to what your catchword was interdisciplinary.
Yes.
Which I think is a great catchword and something that people don't really pay attention to enough, especially with regards to all the weirdness that we talk about and how it's not unscientific to talk about it. It's not unscientific to wonder about it and try to figure out possibly how to increase our understanding of these things instead of having them be, to use the same word, heretical.
That's right. Well, I think that hyperspecialization in science is fine for science, but it doesn't really serve the public at large, especially a public that, an American public, that will be increasingly denied higher education. So what we're in a situation in the United States where children are inculcated with this idea that the only thing that matters is what's in the tabloids or something like that, the tabloidification of news, and that this incredibly shallow and dumb worldview. And basically there aren't enough American kids interested in science, and our birth rate is completely being eclipsed by countries like India and China, and these places in the top universities are being taken by better students, better educated students from other countries, and Americans are being denied a higher education in their own country because
they're too stupid to get in.
They're too stupid to get in because their educational system is right. not is broken, is not working, and they're not being shown how science matters to them and the joy of science.
Yeah, how exciting it can be
yeah.
when it starts to tackle things that, you know what, one way to get young people interested in something I found over and over again is to show them something that they thought was forbidden before and that there's something to it.
Yeah.
But every single time. That's what caught me up in it.
Right. Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Because you're still thinking that, especially when you get a little bit older, like in your teen years and maybe in your 20s, you would like to think that people that are telling you what's going on with the world might be wrong.
I hope so.
Not completely right.
Right. Well, what scares me is when I see young people really choose to be very conservative. That scares me. That's very weird. I don't even understand it, but...
Yeah, I guess I don't either. It's kind of weird.
Maybe if you have insane, wacky, you know, maybe you want, if you have crazy parents that are acting crazily, I have seen that.
Well, that's well known.
People, you know, react to having.
You got hippie parents, you turn into a conservative. If
right.
you have conservative parents, you go the other way
right.
because you just, that's what the generations do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you're lucky, you have maybe some parents that are, or a parent that has a belief system but can explain it very clearly to you and also tell you why you don't have to think that way.
Right.
My father's like that, and I'm very lucky that he is like that.
Well,
he doesn't care what I believe as long, you know, and this is how everybody should be. I don't care what you believe as long as you can explain to me very concretely why you believe that instead of just because.
See, that's where I, again, years ago, I really came away with the idea that the whole idea of believing anything is a hustle in and of itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I was trying to figure how I could get people to strike that word from the vocabulary.
Right.
I wrote a whole column called Belief is the Enemy.
Right.
You know, and then somebody said, no, it isn't. It's just what you think for a while. And I said, no, but everybody thinks...
It's a prison. It's a prison.
Yeah.
And it's right in our head. It's terrible. And it's... we're so hardwired to do it, we can't stop. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, I do it.
Of course. I do it. Everyone does it.
Yeah, and it's funny because you're talking to somebody and that phrase, well, because, comes up in your mind. You go, uh-oh. This is exactly what I hate. I'm
but
not
this is why science
that.
Is so great, because it actually can, and hyper-specialization can actually get to the bottom of some things, but not everything. I'm not sure that it can. I don't think that a laboratory environment, a reproducible setting or whatever, is always the way you're going to get the answer to something.
Yeah, we were talking about this, and that it's limiting.
Mm-hmm.
The view that you can't reproduce something on demand is limiting.
Well, this is... have you ever read The Ever-Present Origin?
Of course not.
what's his name? Jean Gebser. It's another one of these 500-page German books. Yeah, Brick. But I've only sort of didn't have it. But I haven't read the full thing yet. But I sort of skimmed through it and to the best of my ability, I summed up what I was getting. And he was talking about the various phases, the unfoldment of human consciousness. And he says, if you think it's so erroneous to think that just because a phase that is emerging now is better than the other ones, it's not the case. They're all important, because the more primal, the closer it is to source. And he talks about the archaic stage or phase, and he talks about the magic phase. The archaic stage is about really being an animal, and the animalistic, the fact that we are animals on planet Earth, and that when you see animals, they're so much better at being animals than we are at being people. It's hilarious, because we just don't even get that we're animals. But
when we act
like quote unquote animals, it's like some idea of what an animal is, and not the incredible grace and intensity and almost godlike way that animals behave, you know, like wild animals I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And then there's the magic.
In some ways, yes.
Yes.
There's also social structures, especially amongst primates, that are pretty fucked up.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
And look what happened. We're primates.
Right. Well, then, okay, this is...
But you know what? They don't give a shit.
Right.
We're the ones that give a shit.
I think that they have in their... I think that they give a shit within their own... society structure, and it's meaningful.
They give
to them
a shit in a different way
in their own context,
which is why when people say they've encountered aliens or whatever, it's like, how do you know exactly what they're thinking? It's coming through your consciousness.
Well, that's telepathy, and it's your interpretation and how good the apparatus of your database, you know, like in how you interface with things, is how knowledgeable you are. Because, like, for example, I did a translation of a book from Portuguese into English about the Fatima apparitions in Portugal.
Yeah.
And this was witnessed. This occurred on the 13th of every month at noon, or, you know, in the afternoon, broad daylight, on the 13th of every month for 6 months. It was actually...
1904?
No, 1917.
Oh, that's right. It was right before World War One.
It was during, actually.
During?
Portugal was never in World War
One. Oh, okay. That's why I thought it was before. Yeah.
It was happening in Europe, but they weren't in it.
17, 18, 19. Yeah.
It was just towards the end of the First World War. But it was terrible. That's supposed to be the worst war ever. I mean, in terms of
death,
percentage.
Deaths, yeah.
Percentage, yeah. But it was seen by a bunch of illiterate peasants, so the only language that they could use to describe anything was the language of the church. So right. They were saying it looked like the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and, you know, they could only without getting into trouble. But the woman whose work I translated, her name is Fina Darmada, and she actually had no idea what she was getting into at all. She was a women's studies major in a country that had recently gone from being a completely fascist state, like Spain had been under Franco, was Salazar, was Portugal's version of Franco, and to 1975, when they let all their colonies go. You know, you're all free, and they became communists. They're just like part of the EC, and they're socialists like the rest of the EC, basically.
Yeah. When was the book written,
it
originally?
Originally written in 2006.
Oh, okay. What was her point in the book? When you said she didn't know what she was getting into.
Right, because she thought, okay, I'm a women's studies major, and and this was she her when she originally did the research, might have been more like in the 70s or 80s, but and it's now Portugal has become this super liberal, radical, left-wing country that has, you know, women's studies, and you can major in women's studies. That hadn't been happening before. And so she even was a kind of, it seemed even like a conservative thing to make her thesis about would be about Marian apparitions and St. Mary.
Right.
And how she came to Portugal. And she's the most famous woman in 20th century Portugal, and there's a huge tourist industry of pilgrims that go to the sanctuary at Fatima.
Right.
So she just thought it was sort of a nationalistic and nice, fluffy thing to do, and then she saw the original depositions and how they had nothing to do with what the
church said it was.
Continues to say, and I think that actually the current pope was in charge of the dogma department at the Vatican for decades. And he actually was one of the main...
I'm imagining a door that says dogma department on it.
I think it really literally is called something like that. I'm forgetting. It's terrible because I translated it. I didn't write it. And she rewrote a more commercial version of this book where she really reveals it because she was afraid. She was attacked. She was savaged by angry Catholic mobs after her first book came out. And so she was scared to discuss what she actually... what the third secret of Fatima was.
What were the first two? Just bullshit.
Yeah, but I think that the most important one, it was really to her detailing how there's the first depositions that really look, walk, and act much more like later 20th century phenomena that are called the UFO encounters.
Contactee-ish type stuff.
Right. And she was really shocked to see that, and then she also saw the development of the story and how these different people came in and how she had to take a vow of the first witness had to take a vow of silence and was taken from her home and put into a nunnery where you had to take a vow of silence, and then her confessors were Jesuit priests who basically controlled the story to fit the politics, this extreme fascist regime that was in power at the time, which was to consecrate, because they were so horrified at the fact that Russia had been made an atheist state and that the ground of Russia needed to be consecrated to Christ again. And I think that they did even perform some kind of a ritual to that effect.
They went and jumped around and hollered and wore masks and did what they're supposed to do.
But that it was recently. It was within the last decade, I think.
Okay.
That they actually carried it out, the consecration.
So, what was the woman's name?
Fina Darmada. That's D'Arma.
Okay, so when Fina Darmada looked into these records, she actually found the original depositions from that supposedly the Catholic Church sealed up and said you can't see this.
Right, and then that's actually what she was told when they went to the Vatican because later.
Oh, because that's where she had to go to find it because
because she was given they obviously hadn't taken a look at these things and didn't really.
So they were stored in Portugal somewhere in an archive.
Yes, at the sanctuary of Fatima, and so she was given unprecedented and never again access to these documents.
What did she see?
She
just said.
Yeah, but it really was more like UFO-ish type phenomena. Furthermore, this is what's really interesting and not known in the English-speaking world, is that two or three spiritualist groups took out classified ads in the three biggest newspapers in Portugal 6 weeks in advance of the first apparition on May 13th, I believe it was, either May or June 13th, mm-hmm. and published classified ads in the three big most highly circulated newspapers of the country saying that something extremely important was about to happen and to keep your eyes open. And I'll know this better when I actually see the new book because I haven't thought about this. You're taking me places that I wasn't ready to go, but...
Well, that's what we do here.
Yes. And actually, I thought I might get it this week, but the mail is so slow right now, I can't even believe it.
You mean a new edition of the book?
No. She rewrote it, and actually, what was amazing is that the Lucia, the main witness of, mm-hmm. of Fatima, when she was finally, she was on her, she was sick in the nun, she was not in the care of the Jesuits anymore, and she was at a nunnery where the Mother Superior said, please, you just have to write this down, they're breathing down my neck, you have to write down what the third prophecy is. And so she wrote down some...
She hadn't told anybody till then.
Right. And what she described was something that's very, again, very symptomatic of many Close Encounter episodes, which is like scenes of...
apocalyptic scenario
yeah. where she describes a bishop in white strolling through a destroyed city, and across on the top of a hill, like what we drove past today on our way back from Santa Barbara. There's
a cross on top of a hill?
There's a cross on top of it. It's a very Catholic thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, like Rio has the big mm-hmm. Redeemer there.
Yeah. Oh, there's bunches of them all over Southern California.
Yeah.
Well, all over the country, actually.
All over the world. Catholicism is like yeah. one of the biggest religions, if not the biggest religions. And then she found a quatrain in Nostradamus, which
Who
is
did?
Fina d'Armata,
okay.
which almost matched Lucia's words, this quatrain is almost identical, and I don't know what it is yet, but I'm about to get this book and see what it is because she didn't reveal it before. But what does Nostradamus mean in Latin? Okay, he was allegedly he was a converted Jew from the south of France,
right.
who wrote these rhyming verses that were prophecies. Right, mm-hmm. that's the only thing I know about Nostradamus. I'm not a big Nostradamus freak.
Yeah, me either.
I'm not into that, but. What Nostradamus means in Latin is our mother, like Our Lady.
Yeah, yeah. Nostradamus.
It's like the cathedral in Paris, okay?
Yeah,
it's
Notre Dame.
Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And Nossa Senhora in Portuguese, and Nuestra Senhora, and Our Lady.
Who's to say that Luisa didn't see his quatrain?
That's true.
And confabulate it with whatever the
That's
hell.
That's very possible.
Yeah.
It's very possible.
And, if that's the case. And the thing is about...
But what they both do is that they discuss it. I haven't seen this yet, so I don't really know what to... But they both have something to do with Timor. East Timor is what they call it in the United States. We refuse to call it what they call themselves, which is Timor-Leste in Portuguese, mm-hmm. meaning East Timor. But... They want to be called Timor-Leste by everyone, but nobody will do it in the English-speaking world. We yeah. insist on calling it East Timor because it's an Indonesian island. Half of it's cut in half. Half of it's Indonesia, and the other half is free. And the minute that Portugal let go of it as a colony, Indonesia invaded, and they had a 19-year war of liberation and then have had more struggles since. But so there was a big civil war there. And
liberation, meaning the Indonesians thought they were liberating...
No. The Portuguese said, you're free. You're free right. to be free. And then the Indonesians invaded them like 2 weeks later and said, no, you're a part of Indonesia,
yeah.
which is the biggest Muslim nation on the planet. And they're Catholic over there. And they're like, no.
yeah.
So they fought, and they're free. They're their own country now, but they've been embattled. But they are this little... spot of Catholicism in the middle of the Indonesian archipelago, which is the highest nation with the highest population of Muslims on the planet.
And what is mentioned in the prophet? Oh, you just know that
it was talking. Well, she says that she knows who the guy is, and it has to do with Bill Clinton and the UN and his and the fact of Bill Clinton being, she said, allegedly according to her, being a Mason. And that top leaders, Masonic leaders of Portugal, got on the phone with Bill Clinton and said, listen, help East Timor here. Because they're Christian and they want to stay that way. They don't want to be taken over by Indonesia. Because he had been supporting the Indonesians, thinking that that was probably the right thing. And then the Freemasons said, no, they want to be independent and they want to be Catholic.
Right.
And so Bill Clinton actually sent in got the UN to send in troops and planes, and there had been a priest, whose name is Balu. His last name is Balu, which means beautiful in Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And he had been an activist for independence during this whole 19-year war of independence from Indonesia, of East Timor. And this quatrain in Nostradamus also talks about East Timor, and that being a sign that the world had come together, because in the form of quote unquote, the UN. That's what the UN supposedly stands for. Is
I don't know how somebody got East Timor, which didn't even exist at the time, out of Nostradamus.
When was Nostradamus? I think 1400s, wasn't
yeah.
it? Yeah, it did already exist. Portugal was colonizing. It was actually one of the first European colonizers after the fall of the Roman Empire.
I stand corrected.
Yeah. So, and that's actually what the message had to do with, is that little nations are just as important as big ones, and that that colonization and the exploitation of smaller nations is wrong. That's really what the message was. In essence, I haven't seen the new version, but that's what she sort of told me in an email last week.
Wow, nothing about Nostradamus and Timor, really, on the internet.
Right. This is really new stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious to see this book, and we'll take it from there.
You have to get close to the microphone.
Oh. So, yeah, I'll tell you when I see it. I'm just sort of have an idea about it right now.
Well, yeah, well, the next interview has to be over the phone, I guess, because you won't be here in person, probably.
Well, yeah. Unless,
who knows?
Unless things change. Yep. We don't know.
Do you want to take a break?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
I can keep going. I'm fine.
Oh, all right. I was going to play wacky music.
Okay, you can do that.
What do you want to hear? Is there something you heard today that you want to hear?
Yeah, let's play that Japanese Devo stuff.
Oh, you like that, huh? The poly
I don't know if anyone else will, but I do.
I don't care if anybody else likes it. I don't do this show for any of that. I do this show for me, and if people like it, I think that's incredible. I think that's great. But I have never, and people listening know this, I've never done this show to please anybody else. Really. If I can have fun on the show, like I am now, if one person's listening or a million people are listening, I don't mind.
Yeah, Portugal actually, their first colony was Madeira, and that was in the 1300s. And they actually took they completely denuded that island of all its wood, and that's what Madeira means in Portuguese, is wood. They got all their wood from there. They just go there, get the wood, and come back and build stuff with it.
And now they made, and then afterwards they made wine there.
Yep, and they do. And there was a big rainstorm, a lot of problems there last week.
Oh, really?
Huge floods. Yep.
Is it off of Portugal?
It is actually off the coast of Africa.
Oh, okay.
More.
This is the geology we were talking about earlier, and liking geology.
Hmm. It's not as close to. It's actually more in the middle of the southern Atlantic. It's not as close to Africa as Cape Verde is.
Oh, okay.
It's more in the middle of nowhere. It's actually a huge.
Portuguese are one of the first to start leaving and going around the world and checking shit out.
They might be the first. I'm not sure if the Spaniards
in
beat
Europe.
Them. Yeah, after the Roman Empire, like
right,
this idea of colonizing other people.
Right.
And exploiting their resources. I think the Portuguese might have been the first after the Roman Empire to do that. Instead of like staying
300 or 400 years later.
Yeah, to take the stuff and bring it back home.
Right.
And that's entirely what they did to Brazil. They just stripped it of everything they could and shipped it back. And that's what empires do.
How about the Poly Six covering My Sharona?
The what?
My Sharona, remember that song?
I love it. Well, but it's they played that on normal stations.
Yeah, they did. It was like a one-hit wonder for the
Romantics.
No, it was
the Romantics was the name of the group. They were from Miami. It was really weird.
No.
Well, that's what their album's cover said.
My Sharona.
My Sharona, wasn't that? It was the Romantics.
That was
My Sharona.
Yeah, I can't. Who did it? I'm not going to turn the song until I remember who did it. The Knack.
The Knack. You're right. You're right. You're right. I'm wrong.
They had a back cover that looked like a Beatles album. Or they were dressed up looking
like
the Beatles.
Yeah, the Romantics are the guys in plastic suits. The red plastic suits.
What's this?
They were... We're on the scene.
We can talk during it. I don't care. First time people hear this, they go, what the hell? And then they realize what it is. I should have told you, because it's just like... And I've seen them do this live, so it's just incredible.
Tubison.
My Sharona by the Poly Six.
Very nice. Very nice.
I showed Sheikah a picture of... I took a picture of her on the monitor when we were doing the Conspiracy Zone. And I think you said something about a bad hair day that day.
I was having a really bad hair day. Because everything behaves differently here. And I have so much hair on my head.
Yeah, so it just frizzed out.
Well... I expected it to, because in New York it does, and so I over-gelled it for here, and it didn't need it. So
there's what they look like.
I look like Jerry Curls. Man.
I recorded this at a show. I stopped it there.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, we were driving, and Sheikah said, "Hey, I like this." So when somebody says I like something, I tend to overcompensate. So anyway.
That's a big bug, dude.
Oh, yeah, a Hercules beetle at the Pink Sand Dunes, Coral Pink Sand Dunes.
They live in Utah? They're from Utah, or they're not from there?
I think they're native to the state.
Really?
This beetle was about as big as my thumb.
Well, in Brazil, they have things that are even three times bigger than
Yeah, them. I know. Everything's like, bigger in Brazil.
It's true. Brazil has like the biggest everything and the most. It has the most variety of every kind of life form of any nation. More monkeys, more bugs, more fish, more you name it. There's more of them there.
Above ground, not underwater.
Even fish, yeah.
Really?
Freshwater fish, saltwater fish.
No, I mean concentrated in one place. Like there are some reefs that have probably more.
That's probably true. I think you're right that the Great Barrier Reef has the most diversity.
Yeah, biodiversity. But this is
actually the most biodiverse place in the world is the oldest remaining jungle, and it is by the way in Indonesia.
Oh, isn't that where they found the lost mesa where all those strange animals were that.
I haven't heard about this.
Oh, a few years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, it was they were saying that they had found. Well, they weren't saying. I mean, this had happened. Some Western researchers went to this giant mesa somewhere or mountain valley in Indonesia, and found all these animal species that had never been seen before and not cataloged, and it was a big thing for a while.
I'm not surprised. The island of New Guinea. Which is half its own country and half part of Indonesia.
Maybe it was New Guinea.
Yeah, New Guinea. I think that island has more languages than any other place because it's so mountainous and full of valleys that it's really hard. And it's really hard to get around there. And it's some of the roughest terrain and jungle on the planet because it's not just a flat jungle, which is already tough enough as it is.
Yeah.
Jungle is tough. There's nothing.
But mountainous jungle
right.
is.
Yeah, exactly. It's on the equator, and it's...
We were talking earlier today also about the recent spate of earthquakes.
Yes.
Because we saw some of the, you know...
The effects of it. Incredible.
Effects of it just being in Santa Barbara today.
Unbelievable.
A lot of the beach is exposed that wasn't before. I'd see all these rocks that weren't there before. The sand level, the level of the beach in Ventura has dropped by about 4 feet. Due to the storms, probably, and also to the tidal wave surge.
The giant earthquake that actually ripped all, I think, the navigational buoys off of the entrance to the harbor at Ventura.
Yeah, because it surged up like, what?
3 feet, like really fast. It just just popped the buoys off their moorings.
Yeah, and we also saw a this stairway that I usually use to get down to the beach. We saw rocks and sand had been pushed through the stairway out into the highway. Yeah. And we were thinking that was... And it wasn't a thing where it looked like it was all pushed up there in... Well, I don't know. You wouldn't know if it was a bunch of storm waves or if that was the...
On our drive, it was the waves, the high tide were crashing into the...
Yeah, there were a lot of surfers out today.
Yeah.
And it looks like maybe there was one big surge that actually made it halfway out into the highway past that seawall.
Yeah. Which in the Northeast is like la-di-da. I mean, that stuff happens every day in the Northeast. Yeah. But to happen in the Pacific is bizarre.
Yeah, which is why she said, this never happens. It's always
so
chaotic.
Stable. Yeah, yeah.
And I said, well, I guess that's why they called it the Pacific when they first saw it.
It's very stable. That's why you can build the houses right on the beach the way they do here and have highways on the beach like they do. You know.
Why so many earthquakes? So what was
one
in Chile, one in
Haiti before.
Haiti, and then... There was another one really recently, too, another slightly large one in the Pacific Rim
somewhere.
Yes, in
Tonga.
Was it?
Samoa.
American Samoa?
It affected Tonga also because the tidal waves affected even New Zealand.
So what's with all these magnitude 7 and above earthquakes?
Incredibly big. Yeah. Well, our solar system has been moving through a galactic arm since November of 2008. And it's been for more than a year that we've been moving through an area of space as an entire solar system that is bombarding our planet, our solar system, with more cosmic radiation than ever historically measured before. So we're being bombarded by a bunch of radiation rays that we know about it and also rays that we don't know about. But we're talking about the kind of things that go through rocks. We're talking about the things we know about and that we don't. And this is something that I've discussed on other shows, is how this scientific story has been managed since its inception first it was like, oh my God, this is happening, this is record breaking. Then it's just been at this sustained level of bombardment.
The reflection of your how red you are there.
Oh my God, yeah. I got blind.
That's the only shiny thing I could think of. I held up a knife to Chica and I said, look at this. Like,
well, that's just, I've been in a rat hole editing for 6 months straight without going outside at all.
So, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Okay, so this is...
About the cosmic ray bombardment.
Yeah, this is just speaking to that everything is related, and it's a very interesting and wonderful thing to know that there's nothing separate. Everything is is related to each other. Everything is connected. So the fact that we're going through some kind of area of the Milky Way where we're being bombarded by a higher level of cosmic rays than ever previously measured.
What form do these cosmic rays take?
Well, it's throughout all the spectrum of radiation. The ones that, as I said, that we know about, like gamma, X-rays, photons, and things that are destructive, that are ionizing radiation, that are destructive to DNA. Oh, yeah, there's going to be a spike in cancers and mutations. That's what's going to happen.
What you would think... That passing through an area of cosmic radiation of all these things along the electromagnetic spectrum you're talking about would not be affecting something as tough as rocks. And why does it?
Well, I think that everything is resonating at various frequencies at various times, and that this must be affecting. The frequency of everything.
Has anybody put forward a theory as to why so many earthquakes are happening at once? Normal mainstream scientist.
I think Paul LaViolette is about as good of an example of someone who does that as anyone.
Okay, somebody that everybody would quote. And then we'll get back to LaViolette.
No. But he's
They're saying it's coincidence that all these earthquakes are happening... Strong ones.
Well, no, because
over the last
see the way
months.
We have it is that only earthquake people talk about earthquakes, and only astronomers talk about astronomy. So there's no interdisciplinary talk almost allowed, except for when you have renegade scientists who actually do talk to each other.
So why would, and we'll talk about Violette in relation to this, but why would astronomers be talking about? Any kind of radiation that would affect the Earth's crust to the point where it would cause earthquakes?
Well, that's definitely a theory that's advanced by Paul LaViolette and others.
Okay.
That the end of the last ice age.
The point is that they wouldn't.
No, because they're not interdisciplinary, because astronomy people do astronomy and geophysicists do their thing.
So why is LaViolette different? What is he saying?
Because he's so smart that nobody can. He even does work for like the highest levels of everything, and he's right. And he talks about basically he's one of the proponents of geomythology, like Bruce Massey in the Holocene Epoch Working Group. Which is a consortium of scientists that include people from Columbia University and from universities all over the world of different disciplines. And they basically say that they're taking the theory that was first advanced in 1975 in the book called Hamlet's Mill to its ultimate conclusion, really actually displaying...
What was the theory
advanced? That was that the language of mythology is really a... It's a ancient priestly language to describe celestial events at a time before the language of science existed. So it was an encoded language that uses stories to tell stories about things that are really celestial phenomena.
Right, right.
And that the priests knew more, had a better idea that these were talking about astronomical events. People who were so initiated into the truth about what these things really meant.
So they didn't really think that there were gods running around the heavens pushing things around.
Right.
They looked at it in the way that we think you should probably look at it as, like you said, as using the language as a metaphor.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so that was first advanced by an MIT professor, Giorgio Di Santayana, and... Erta von der Schend, who's a professor in a German university, and they wrote a book called Hamlet's Mill in 1975. It's another 500-page brick that's illegible because it's so arcane and scientific or whatever, but that's what the premise of that book is. And if you take it to its ultimate conclusion, that's what these interdisciplinary scientists have done, is that you have – they're taking the best brains in geophysics and astrophysics and mythology and history – and also using Google Earth maps and finding the locations and saying that, you know what, Noah's flood actually happened as a result of an asteroid impact in the South Indian Ocean in 2807 on May 10th, B.C.
Because they found
They cross-referenced enough global legends that also mentioned an eclipse so that they were actually able to date.
What does an eclipse have to do with a meteorite?
It doesn't. It's just a coincidence in this case. But it allows for a date.
Oh, I see what you mean. To help date.
Yeah, to date it. And then the subsequent association by many cultures of eclipses with bad tidings.
Right. You also said that there was a... To back this up, there was a meteor crater.
Yes, they found
at the bottom of the ocean.
I think it's like 20... It's called the Burkle Crater. It's under 12,000 feet of water. It's off the coast of Madagascar, and it's about 28 kilometers in diameter. And they have found the shocked quartz and the other things at the site of the impact itself that are indicators of an asteroid impact or something like that. And then they have found what are called chevron dune formations. And then they triangulated these dunes on Australia, 600 miles inland in Australia, that have the molten spherules and microalgae fossils from that time, and also in
Africa,
in Madagascar.
There. Oh, okay.
And the same, but so then they triangulated where these dunes were, and then also saw, with the help of Google Maps, were able to actually find this thing, and then prove that the microfossils in the two places that were thousands of miles apart are the same, and that were caused by the same event, an impact.
So how does it cause and you explain this to
me,
but
well,
40 days and 40 nights, quote unquote, of rain,
which is, it's a global legend that appears in African mythology, it appears everywhere. There, I think Bruce Massey was given access to UCLA's database of South American mythology east of the Andes, only 4,500 myths just right there in that data pile, and then more all over globally. And they talk basically, if you have something that's about a kilometer wide, which is what they think this thing was,
right, because of the impact crater it left,
right.
they
it's
could
usually that's
back
the,
engineer what the size of the,
yeah, that's, there's actually a specific, it's usually about that much, 30 times, the diameter is about 30 times greater than the size of the object.
Yeah.
So, and in the case, well, we have the one we all know about, the most famous one, but it's the one that made the dinosaurs extinct 65 million years ago.
Yeah, the Yucatan one.
The Yucatan one. So, but this one was much more recent. It was only 5,000 years ago.
Well, with all these, well... Just to get back to the rain, what you explained to me was what the theory was.
Yeah,
is that
it lofted so much, so many millions and millions of gallons of seawater into the air, that it took that much, a month or more for it to rain back down on the earth, and it was salt water, and it just spoiled the crops, it killed the vegetation. That's what salt water does. I mean, like I said, I've seen it firsthand when there was a hurricane in June and the house that I rented on Fire Island never turned green. The vegetation never turned green that summer because the hurricane had breached under our house.
And it takes a while for the rain to come in and leach that salt back out so the things can grow there.
Right, and that's probably green by now, but this was back in 1998.
Right, and what was the other question I had about the asteroid?
Or no, it was 96, sorry.
That it. Oh, I don't know what I wanted to ask. Because of the however you pronounce the crater in Yucatan, Ixchiquilub crater,
Chicxulub
crater,
which actually means something in Maya, in classic Maya.
What does it mean?
It means tail of the devil, meaning the whatever it is that all you could see was the tail sticking out of it.
Oh,
and
well, where did the name come from?
The priests named it because
that area.
Yeah, they named it that because they were shamanic, and apparently could see that. You couldn't tell by looking at the place now. The place is gorgeous, you know.
Yeah.
It's a jungle, and it's beautiful.
Well, it was then, too.
Yes, because it was relatively recent. You know, the Maya thing only collapsed. It collapsed. The Maya collapse really happened about 1000 AD, so 500 years before the Spaniards really got there. So it gave the jungle all this time to cover all of the incredible temples and keep it away from the destruction of the Spaniards until after the Spaniards were gone. And it was really mostly discovered in the 20th century, the Maya pyramids. So right. It was the biggest story they only started to really decode it in the 80s, the glyphs. But they had actual books that were burned en masse by the conquistadors.
Right, right. And there are just a very few sort of Rosetta Stone type
books that they're basically their.
I used to have one
old,
of those. It was called the Codex. There's all the, because it's named after the people.
Right, the Dresden Codex.
I had the Codex Mendoza.
Oh, okay.
Which had it was basically just boring accountings of how much tax people had paid to the capital.
Wow.
Because of this they were able to back engineer the language, because apparently a priest or two or three had gone and had enough interest in the Mayan language and the pictographic language to record it.
Well, no, what they actually did was have people, and then they realized it was wrong. They would have Mayans actually sound it out for them, and then so they're written in Roman letters. What is it, phonetically?
Right, right.
And then they realized that the language is a rebus. The pictograms aren't exact. It's more like he saw, you know, those things that you see in the bottle cap.
Yeah. If you live in the East, they didn't have those out here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but we know what a rebus is. The question I have about the meteorites is: is that called the KTE boundary?
Yes, the one that happened in Chicxulub.
Okay, and that's found all over the world.
Yes.
Though. Well, what about these other meteorite impacts? Are there other boundary layers?
Well, that one was...
that's only 2,000 years ago. It's not much geologic time.
Right.
The thing is,
it wasn't as big of an object, because the thing that slammed into the Yucatan at Chicxulub was like 6.5 miles wide.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't half a kilometer or a kilometer. It was a much bigger thing. So what the Holocene Impact Working Group says is that we're impacted with things that are... half a kilometer or bigger every 1,000 years on average. So
aren't we way overdue?
Well, they said that the fall
by
of the Roman,
that logic.
Well, no, because a more recent one happened to cause the fall of the Roman Empire. They're suggesting there's also tree ring evidence. That's a whole other science called dendrochronology.
Yes.
Where they can measure, and then there's also the core samples that they can take in Greenland and other
glacier. Well, wouldn't there have been some... Oh, but the thing is that there weren't many people, so there were uninhabited areas where something like that could happen.
Right.
But what is the evidence?
They found it. The candidates for the thing that caused the end of the final blow of the end, around 536, 537 A.D.,
in what way? Like in crop failures
or
something?
Yes, it caused mass famine, and it was caused the end of the Roman Empire,
too. Okay, it wasn't just the Mongolians and the...
No, it happened in England. You see, what's his name? The historian who was part of Roman England, when England was... that's actually when the Franks took over and kicked the Romans out.
Oh, okay.
What are they called? Not the Franks, the Angles and the Saxons are the ones who really did it, got the Romans out of there.
Because they kicked ass. Yeah. And the Romans were all weak and pissed off and tired of it.
Yeah.
And probably not getting their wheats.
Well, it also sucked, and it was rainy and not as nice as Italy.
What are we doing in this cold country? I want to get the fuck out of here. I'm tired of this shit.
So, but they actually have the candidates for the impact zones for the crater. It was actually probably all over, you know, like a bunch of small asteroids that hit.
Where?
It's called the Gulf of Carpinteria, which is interesting because there's a town called Carpinteria over here. But this is the Gulf of Carpinteria, which is on the northern Australian coast.
Okay.
Which, where there weren't a lot of white people, yeah, and or Western civilization.
I don't think there were a lot of any people. Oh, well, at that point, yeah, there was an Aboriginal civilization.
Right.
All over the southern, southeastern, southwestern Pacific.
No, right. So, but this is, you're right, there were. And be interesting to take a look at their stories from that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, from, especially from that time.
Well, there's a whole field called archaeoastronomy.
Yes.
That some people know about.
Yes.
I'm interested in it in relationship to the Southwest because I for a long time I had an interest in petroglyphs mm-hmm. and pictographs on rocks, and archaeoastronomers were all over that shit.
Yes.
The most obvious being the so-called supernova glyph in Chaco Canyon.
Right. And then there's a whole maybe, you know, it's very un-mainstream views, Velikovskian views about what
yeah,
all
we
of
were
that
talking
means.
About catastrophism and
yeah.
how that's still heretical. It's just something you don't talk about.
You're not allowed, like
in mixed company.
And actually, you have beautiful works written by the Royal Astronomer, who's still alive. And he says, "Well,
you mean the one that last week said that we wouldn't know there were aliens here because we have no way to perceive them, possibly." That same Royal Astronomer that's working now?
No, he resigned. He was pissed, and he went back to Oxford, and now he's retired because he's...
Oh, what did he say? That? Why did he get pissed off?
Well, he didn't. He was like, I give up. You know, he just did it as a side hobby and wrote books about it and then did the official...
About what? Stuff. About catastrophism?
Well, no, he was saying that we're not doing enough about near-Earth objects and that
yeah.
we need to...
But now we are.
We're finally getting it because there's one that really is about to hit us. And
well, there's been about 8 zillion close calls
in the last, because we're in this arm right now.
Yeah.
If you look at every day, there's like 1,000. There was a day in February where this object came within a third of a lunar distance between us and the moon.
How big was the object?
I don't know. It was something that I saw on spaceweather.com. But it was big. It was like the size of a football field or something like that.
Big enough to cause problems.
You know, wipe out like a quarter of the population of the planet or something.
Because what's that called? The near Earth object. There's automated cameras working constantly, 24 hours tracking that now.
Finally, well, they just put up actually in January or December, the WISE infrared camera that's starting to map out. But they're not really revealing. They're going to chaw over the data for a long time before they reveal it. But, you know, it's your tax dollars at work, so we should know about that stuff. And supposedly...
Do you think... Here's Art Bell. Well, do you think if there was something like that was going to destroy civilization, would it be revealed to the public?
Well, as Roland Emmerich's trailer for his movie said, no. Find out for yourself.
Yeah. It would just cause too much panic.
Yeah.
Might as well just have everybody go, holy shit, what was that?
Right. Because then they'll stop paying their taxes and they'll stop going to work and they'll start yeah. trying to squeeze the last couple days out of life that they can.
It'll be festival.
Like, we're gonna
like
work.
On Star
Yay!
Trek.
No, I never saw that episode.
Oh, well, it's just the old Star Trek. They go to this planet where the whole planet is controlled by a computer. Wait. It's the insane mad communist gangster computer god controls this planet.
Nice.
And because it's controlling all these living things, it decides that one day a year everybody can just go ape shit and not be under any control whatsoever. So they come into this village and everybody in the village sees these strangers, you know, Kirk and Spock with the hat over his ears like every time. Ask them if they're here for the festival. Are you from the valley? Yes. Are you here for the festival? Yeah, we're here for the festival. And what happens is the computer shuts off for one day or an hour or something like that, and everybody steals, rapes, pillages, loots, kills each other and all that. And then it switches back on and everybody goes back to being controlled.
That's so
again.
Funny because that's the opposite.
It's like a little venting thing.
See, in Brazil it's the opposite. That's the day that everybody stops stealing and pillaging. And they start just dancing and having... They just stop. Crime stops. It's amazing. I've been there.
Yeah.
And it just becomes really about
having
infinite creativity and infinite
and fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
But if you think it was like that all the time, the crime would creep back.
Yes. So they have to make it like that.
It's I wonder if it's the same. I wonder if you can find the same statistic for other places celebrate. What's that period? Lent? No.
Yeah, Lent is the period that follows.
Okay. That
Festival of the Flesh. Yeah. That's what Carnival means.
Right.
Literally.
Right. Yeah, Mardi Gras Fat Tuesday. It's the Tuesday before Lent.
Right. Right. Anyway, same. It's the same thing.
Yeah. I wonder if that in other places where that festival is celebrated mm-hmm. in various ways.
Well, in Portugal, it's very big. Like
I know, it's huge. It's like the biggest thing there.
In Catholicism.
Yeah, it's like Mardi Gras times 8 zillion.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you would, in any society that practices that kind of thing, mm-hmm. if the crime goes down during periods of great creativity and celebration.
Oh.
And I bet it would be practically the same across all of them.
Well, what I noticed in Brazil is that they roll out the carnival type of behavior when their favorite soccer team wins and stuff.
Like, yeah, well,
even in São Paulo, which is not.
Yeah,
real.
Well, here they start breaking store when it's festival.
Oh,
you know, and when the Bulls won the NBA or something, I was in Chicago. I was here when the Lakers won it too, and people go ape shit and they start doing riotous things, setting police cars on fire. All right.
No, well, that's because we're American and we're crazy. Yeah. There,
Well, there may be cultural differences in the way people handle
joy.
Yeah. There's a whole. I'm sure somebody's written a paper on it. You know somebody's written a paper.
They
on
better
it.
Have.
What else did we say we were going to talk about when we were on the listening to the Poly Six?
Paula Violette.
We could, because I referenced him in Project Beta. He wrote, what was it
Earth
called?
Under Fire.
Well, he wrote that, but I referenced a paper or a short book he wrote, which I have a copy of. It's about anti-gravity, I think.
Oh, really? Yeah. He's just so smart that he's untouchable. It's great. I love
untouchable
that
untouchable by whom?
You know, by the powers that be that don't want to talk about anti-gravity and about non-propulsion and non-petrochemical-based.
Well, if he wants to say stuff, why doesn't anybody hear it? Because nobody wants to cover it?
Well, he does. YouTube. He's like the king of YouTube.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
If he's untouchable, then it would seem...
He works at like a huge, major... I think he works... I don't know, remember which one, but he works for the Very Large Array in New Mexico.
So. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then probably for, like you said, maybe...
Sandia.
Or Los Alamos or...
I don't think he works for Los Alamos. I think okay. Sandia.
I've heard strange rumors about Los Alamos and quite a many different.
Well, if you go to their website, it's very liberal and groovy. They honor people like Hannes Alfgren, who I was telling you about the other night. He was the one man who really championed the plasmic model of the universe, which is termed as an alternate cosmology because it's not does not believe in the Big Bang theory.
Right.
It believes that everything is connected interdimensionally through electromagnetism in our dimension in 3D.
Is that the so-called electric theory?
Yes,
of the cosmos?
It is.
Yes,
yes,
okay.
It is. And then you have this, if you go Google the electric universe, probably. I quote this in my last book, The Electric Universe. You have mythologists and stuff, and they're also...
Which book was that?
2012 Science or Superstition, which is the companion book to the film by Disinfo.
Uh-huh.
But I went into areas... The way that a book can, because a movie can only do like 30 pages, you know, can only...
Right, right.
It can't really do...
Well, depending on... It's what? It depends. It's like a page a minute.
Right, right. So, my book is like...
Elaboration all
the
things.
It's almost 400 pages long. It's 100,000 words, my book, so... That's a lot of minutes. It's too much for a movie. So... it's long. And I actually had to take out 50,000 words of it and just put it on the website. There's a timeline. If you go to 2012sos.net/the-book, you'll get to my book's webpage. And if you click actually on the whole website, just sos.net, 2012sos.net, on the top it says timeline, and that's something that I aggregated from a bunch of sources, among
them...
Do
you smell the burrito truck? The taco truck?
Yes, I do. I do smell it.
That taco truck drives me nuts. Go ahead.
one of the main persons who put that it's basically the timeline of impacts is Laura Knight Yadzik, who has a website called Cassiopeia.com, and she's a friend of mine. And also I just went to Wikipedia and to other sources and put together basically a timeline in the past 12,000 years. The Holocene epoch, which is the end of the, since the end of the last ice age.
That's another thing.
Earth history and human history. Yeah, and the end of the last ice age is...
That's another thing that you were bringing up as a mystery.
A lot of splaining to do. Because, you know, it's not, what's, not well explained.
Well, what's not well explained about it?
Well,
why did the Earth warm up and the glaciers slowly retreat? Or did they?
Well, it's very hard to explain how they can find an almost perfectly preserved mammoth last year.
Another one?
Yes.
Where?
In northwestern Siberia.
Not Siberia again. Well, that's the only place that still has the ice since then.
Right. And so, and it's melting. And so then this guy, he was up there and found it. He was just a fisher trapper kind of guy. And wasn't sure what it was, but literally the proboscis of the mammoth, it was a baby animal, and just the hair was gone, but the skin was perfectly flash frozen mammoths. When they asked a guy at Birdseye, the flash frozen vegetables company, what it would take to do that,
to preserve it like that,
he said, you know, it's just like something unimaginable. The amount of, I mean, to do that to the whole planet, to like flash freeze it.
How the whole planet?
Well that whole
Siberia.
Area, yeah, right, or that area of the planet, and then to, you know,
and they could tell it didn't just die and freeze.
It was flash frozen. There's some that literally were still standing, still had clover blossoms in their
mouths. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I've heard about this.
And it happened like instantaneously. It happened very fast.
What could cause that?
I don't know. But what Paula Violette says is that there was a supernova explosion that a stellar fragment, and this is also Richard Firestone and a bunch of other geophysicists, astrophysicists, etc. So Richard Firestone and Paula Violette and others are proponents of a theory that a stellar fragment or some kind of an impact occurred in what is now the Great Lakes area of North America, and what was at that time 3 miles deep of glacier.
Right.
And
that's what formed the Great Lakes.
That's right, it's melted glacier, and it's still unbuckling. And that's,
well, it was scooped out by the glacier at first.
Yeah.
A lot of it.
It's retreating glacier, but it's also melted glacier. Mm. And it's actually still, the land itself is still coming back up, rising back up from the pressure of the glacier. And so this is causing...
What, the glacier that isn't there anymore?
Yeah.
How is it still rising from the glacier then?
That's actually a phenomenon that's happening in Europe as well, and it's causing Holland to get smaller and parts of Scandinavia to get bigger. And, you know, the Dutch already have a problem with lack of land.
Right,
They're like, oh, come on, please.
Well, that's okay. It's something that they'll have to worry about in 1,000 years. Oh, well.
Right.
Now, if the sea level rises...
They're worried about... I mean, the Dutch are the most prepared for that than anyone, and then the English are very good. If you've seen their system of protection, we don't have anything. It's going to be a big Katrina for us if something raises it very quickly. Sorry. Like what happened last night, you know, that ripped the moorings off just by 3 feet. I mean, that was just 3 feet.
Yeah, well, I guess it's not something that happens very often, so the extra cost it would entail to protect against something like that is just not figured in.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas any building built in Los Angeles in the last 20 or 30 years...
is dealing with earthquakes.
Is and San Francisco or any place up and down the coast is built so that it flexes or slides around on the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's something people have to worry about every, you know, every, probably about every 50 years here. Or, no, what is it? 100 and something years is a nasty one in L.A. Every 100 something years.
Well, then that already happened. Well, no, it's more than that because there was one, a big one in the early 70s, and then there was a big one in the early 90s. So it's like 20 years.
Okay, it was more like that. But no, but but those weren't, you know, the one in the early, those, neither of those I think went above 5.
Really?
Yeah, the Northridge one. Northridge one might have been. Well, we can
7,
look it up.
I think it was more like 7. Something.
7's nasty, though.
I know.
I was in that one.
I had just left. I was like, yes, but then I saw the what happened in.
So as soon as you got to tell me what day you're going to leave, so then I can hunker down.
All right, I'm really good at not being at the place. Like I had a dream about September 11th, and my apartment was a half a block away, and I was gone. I was out of the country for the first time in 6 years when it actually happened, and watched it on TV from Rio. But, you know, it was half a block. That would have sucked. And I actually talked. My neighbor got stuck. My neighbor across the hall got stuck in the building the whole time.
Why? Because they wouldn't let people leave?
Or? Yeah, they wouldn't let people leave. And he was already he's a little bit of a obsessive compulsive disorder guy. He's a sweetheart. But so he just stayed. He said, well, I had a case of wine and I had food, you know. And he toughed it out. But he grabbed me and told me the whole story of what it was like to be there, stuck there for 2 weeks, because I couldn't get in. First of all, I was supposed to fly in that following Thursday, but back to New
Northridge,
York.
6.7.
So that's close to 7. But it ain't no 7. But then there was the one in San Francisco right before then.
You mean the World Series one?
The one where the bridge collapsed and the car... People got crushed.
Loma Prieta?
Yes.
7.1.
Yeah. My sister was just missed being on the bridge by like 20 minutes. No. She had just gone over it.
Yeah, so there hasn't been anything in Southern California near a 7 in quite a while.
I don't need that. Thank you.
Except Northridge, which was pretty nasty.
Well, there were also so many aftershocks. I would talk to people, and it was still
There were tons of them. Mammoth Lakes is another area. Well, Mammoth Lakes is a completely different thing. It's so geologically active that there's areas of forest that are dying because of CO2 outgassing coming out of the ground. In fact, they tell people not to go camping there because the CO2 gets trapped in your tent and you suffocate.
Oh my God, that's really awful. It's like deadly. It's like Death Valley. It's like a deadly place.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you fly over it, you can see these like brown areas where the trees have been killed by all the CO2 coming out of the ground.
Oh my God! Well, maybe that's what's the thing that when I drove across the country this summer in July and Utah, like these areas that are completely unpopulated, the trees were all dying. Is there some kind of a bug that's doing that, or?
Well, there might be. It might be some sort of fungus or blight or something on the trees at in that area.
Mm.
I remember I was camping there, actually with Miles, who was messaging us on Facebook. We were camping there during the hantavirus outbreak.
Oh, my God.
In this Four Corners area about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. And on the top of that, we camped in an area where these two guys had escaped from prison, and
oh my God.
They're running through the countryside stealing cars and killing people.
Oh my God.
And we heard about it on the radio. I was like, well, what are we going to do? We want to camp. So we just camped. What are we going to do? So that's saw them.
I was actually
camping. Apparently they passed by very near where we were, like the day before or the day after we left, like within a couple of miles.
I have a similar thing. I was camping on an island in the middle of Georgian Bay, which is part of Lake Huron, with a bunch of Canadian friends from Toronto, and we got back, and they tried to swipe our card at the park to pay for the nominal fee, yeah. You know, like $10 a day or whatever it was. We'd been there for 2 weeks, and it wouldn't go through, so we said, oh, okay. He said, I think that there's a power outage, and they looked around, and they said, oh, we're on reserve right now. We're not on the grid. We're using our own right now. Hmm. So we said, okay, they'll probably be a little while, so we'll come back. We'll go to the grocery store and we'll come back. And then when we went to the grocery store, it had just happened. The power was out, but the ice was still frozen. The food was still fine. It had just happened, the huge northeast blackout of 2003. So we decided, well, let's scoop up some groceries and get back onto the island. So we took our rowboat, we filled it up with food and took it back to the people, and they had a battery-powered radio over there, so we stayed there for another week until it settled down. But then what was interesting was that New Yorkers responded to that in such an interesting way, because they'd already been through 9/11, and they decided to just be really cool to each other.
Yeah.
and that it actually brought out a lot of, you were actually asking about what a society would do, you know, under certain pressures. And
yeah.
New York responded to that 4-day blackout, I think 4-day plus, by just giving free beers to people and hanging out in candlelight and singing. And
yeah. So. I have a feeling that just about any urban area might be a kind of similar. In fact, when there have been power outages or during the riots or whatever, I noticed in my neighborhood, which wasn't really affected by them except people looted Melrose a little bit, some people turned into dicks and most people turned in. I met people that I lived next to for years that I hadn't known before.
Yeah.
And we talked about what was happening and, you know, what you had seen and what was on the news and that guy that was shooting at people over on La Brea and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, you know, it draws people together when everybody's sharing something like that.
Well, I've heard a similar story.
How long does it take before the sharing turns into, I'm tired of this shit and I'm starting to get scared of my neighbors?
That's a good question. And I think it really depends on the situation and just the whole, everything, the disposition and what yeah. people think is true and what they believe, etc. But I've been told something interesting by somebody who, from Poland, a young man in his 30s now, who said that he remembers the days of communism from his childhood, and in a way, people had, because there was nothing, nobody had anything,
right.
They had only each other.
Yeah.
And so you had to really create a network of friends, like real, not virtual friends, but real ones.
Right.
So you could leave your child with your neighbor and be totally sure and fine that the child was safe.
Right, right.
And go do whatever you had to do. And then he said that once capitalism came in, people became all obsessed with their stuff and they don't talk to each other as much. And it's actually, there's something about that that makes it not as good as how it was before in some ways.
Yeah, true. But then also you see people that are fanatics saying that that ownership of any property screws everything up and
yeah.
we should take it away from it. It's like,
well, but or the way communism was being practiced, my parents would go to Russia a lot when it was still communist and describe what going to a restaurant was like back then, which was like you go
for people that weren't Russian even too.
Right.
Which is still slightly different than.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they would describe that it would be like you'd go into this basement and get a chit, like a scrap of paper from the cashier person, present it to the person behind the bank, and then they'd give you a bowl of slop that was like disgusting, and then it was worth like pennies, and then that was it. There was no competition. Everything was just called pektopot. Looks like restaurant in Russian. It looks like pektopot to us, but it's in Cyrillic. It's restaurant. And it was just called restaurant, and that was it.
And there which basically translated as you don't have to cook or clean up tonight.
Right. Right. But it was like totally foul and disgusting. And there was nobody trying to make a better one, so they didn't have to.
And this was
up.
For people. This was for tourists too.
Yeah.
That's frightening.
Yeah. Just not. And they said that the whole place just smelled like sewage. It was just disgusting. So that was Russia in the 70s.
Yeah, I don't know. I have problems with people that are. Well, you know
what?
That was
Moscow in
okay.
the 70s.
And it was even Moscow.
Yeah.
The cosmopolitan city of Russia.
Yeah.
At the time, or USSR.
Capital, the capital of the Soviet Union, yeah.
Couldn't serve a decent restaurant meal.
Yeah, they couldn't. No, because they were too busy robbing, you know, everything. It was just. Or not being able to produce anything properly. So, I mean, now it's like gangsters are running it, but is it
right?
Is it worse? Is it better? I don't know. I mean, it's probably like...
Well, the KGB is coming back, or it has been, because...
well, because of Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, because Putin used to be the head of the KGB, and now I talked to a guy that worked at Los Alamos, a scientist there, and he said that in the last maybe 5 years... And this was probably 2 or 3 years ago. He said they're starting to worry about KGB running around in the United States again when they didn't used to. Now it's a problem again because that part of their police state is being built up again.
It's very strong.
Well, it was.
It's also that we're so weak. Our currency is so weak. I went to go renew my Brazilian passport, and because I lost it. Just now, it was like so busy and moving. I think I threw it out by accident, and so I reported it and whatever. And I'm getting a new one, And so in 2008, when I renewed it, when it became expired, it only cost $30. But to renew it now, it's $80. And it's strictly based on the exchange rate from the dollar to the real.
Yeah, and then you pointed out to me earlier, too,
it's more than double
that
the cost of what it was only
because the dollar is so weak.
Less than a year and a half ago, that's how weak the dollar has gotten.
And then you pointed out to me that Brazil is trying to shore up the United States now, because if the United States goes, they're not going to have one of their big trading partners.
It's their biggest trading partner, and they are contributing to the IMF to bail us out right now.
Right. Is China doing the same thing?
I don't know that they can. They need us to buy their stuff.
Yeah, because one of the arguments I hear from people all the time is like, as soon as China calls in those tickets, we're screwed.
The treasury notes, because they own most of our debt.
But the thing is, if they screw us, they screw themselves.
Yeah, they can't. They
at
can't.
This point.
They can't right now.
Yeah.
No, what's happening right now is that there are millions of people unemployed in China, and that one thing that communism did guarantee was employment, and now it can't even do that because we're so screwed up. Our economy is so screwed up. It's putting Chinese people out of work. Millions of them.
Yeah.
So, be interesting to see how this all shakes out.
Well, it's pretty shaky. I didn't work for a year. Mm-hmm. Almost a year, 11 months, and that was frightening. The weird thing recently about this recent problem was that I used to be able to call up friends and have a job in a week. Like, I'd make a decision, like, I don't want to work here anymore. Mm-hmm. I'd call two or three people, and I have a job.
There isn't... No, this town is empty. This town is
gone.
It
doesn't work anymore. It didn't work for me.
It's empty.
Everybody is like, I don't know. I'm barely keeping my job, or I don't have one anymore either, and I have no idea.
All the kids have gone back to Ohio.
I noticed that, too.
Stars. All the things are for rent. Everything's empty.
Yeah. In my neighborhood, I was lucky to get somebody renting in my apartment building. Yeah. I manage an apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky to get somebody there because the neighborhood is just emptying out over the last year, which is nice because now there's parking.
There are
too many
cars.
Doesn't seem to make any difference on the freeways. No. But, a lot of
the
people...
No, I think that the gas prices didn't make a measurable impact last year when I was here. Apparently, it did cause less people to drive.
Not me.
Not the people that have to. They have no choice.
Well, I didn't have to because I wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
But I went flying a lot, and I get 55 or 60 miles a gallon in my car, so I just kept going. And that's what there's another thing I've noticed, that every time somebody introduces a new electric car, it's like, this is the electric. It's like, the fucker can't go more than 100 miles before you run out of juice.
Yeah.
What the hell's wrong with you people?
I know. I drove across the country in a Prius. Mm-hmm. I drove over the Rockies in a Prius. That was hilarious, man. That was some funny stuff.
Although the Volt is doing the same thing that that small car company Aptera in San Diego did, which was inventing a car. And I used to talk about this with my father in high school, when I was in high school.
Yeah.
He says, I don't know why there's no electric cars. All you have to have is a little tiny gas motor that charges the battery when it goes down.
Yeah.
That's all you need. You can get hundreds of miles out of a tank, maybe up to 1,000 miles out of a tank of gas, 10-gallon tank of gas. If you just had a little tiny generator, a little piston engine generator generating your electricity when you start, and then use regenerative braking and going downhill and all that other stuff.
Right.
Didn't happen.
No.
Aptera tried to do it. Now, suddenly, Chevy, who is in the toilet, is coming out with the Volt, which is that's the exact idea behind it.
Well, actually, interestingly enough, I knew the guy who was in charge of the
fuels. And I know what people are going to say. It's like the oil thing. But
he was laughing at it. I think that the whole attitude of, what's his name, the president of GM?
I don't remember.
CEO of GM. It's like Bob something. My father actually knew him because he worked in Brazil before he came to
Filthy
Detroit.
McNasty.
Yeah, exactly. He's just like Mr. like, you know, global warming, bolt, you know, whatever. He's anti-global warming, which is might even be fine, but
I'm glad you said that.
But he was saying, because a lot of people are attributing, first of all, they're saying there's nothing global about it. It's solar system wide. You're seeing increased luminosity of the gas giants. You're seeing that the
over how long, though?
Since this event started happening in November 2008.
Okay, but the warming was supposedly started back when.
That's true.
But the thing is, exponentially might mean that this recent
really
influence...
It really is an astrophysics... physical phenomenon or byproduct. Mm-hmm. That's what some people allege, and other people say no. That's there's people who argue against it. I don't know. I'm not an astrophysicist, and I don't do that. I just read it. But and not enough of it. I was doing something else. I've been producing 3 movies, so different.
Any movies that we should know about? Closer to microphone.
Oh, this is a cool one. 2012, The Beginning, starring John Major Jenkins, directed by Morgan Harris.
Okay.
That I was a co-producer on. And
what's that about? It's about an hour and a half. What is the subject matter?
That's hilarious. It's really about John Major Jenkins' life work. It's really, and it also has really cool Terrence McKenna audio from a lecture he gave at Esalen, and it's really cool, and some really just beautifully shot, incredible cinematography of the, you know, time-lapse photography of the temples all over Guatemala and Belize and stuff like that, and of Manhattan, and showing sort of the similarity of the end of a civilization and of ours, potentially. And
that's the idea of the film, is that we're...
Well, that's that was certainly McKenna's idea, yeah. That's what a lot of people are saying.
Oh, well, that was his Time Wave Zero thing.
Yeah. Which
morphed into the 2012 thing because he was referencing that.
Yeah, he used it because he needed to peg a date, an end date, to make all the other dates line up. And so he decided to cross the I Ching, which is a system of 64 patterns.
Yes, on the face of it, it's a fortune telling oracle thing, but it takes into account like 64 and whatever the
hexagonal or something like that.
Yeah, patterns that can be thrown with these with coins.
Coins
to quote unquote predict the future, but the thing is, it takes into account a shitload more stuff than.
Well, some people say that it's actually based on a lunar calendar from Neolithic times in China.
Mm, okay.
And it was really about farming, just like most calendars. But
so the Farmer's Almanac isn't into 2012, I guess. But oh well.
Well, we got to check that out.
Well, you know what? Somebody asked me if I wanted to. No, it wasn't about 2012. But if they did, I don't think I'd want to write a book about 2012 because I'm undecided about it. What do you think of? Is there a significance to the date? And if there is, you know, can we make a specific statement about it?
Well, the thing that you can make a specific
besides
statement
Adam Gorightly retires
about,
that year,
is that the Maya were insanely accurate with their calculations. In a way, for example, like we have astrology in the West that's based on a Babylonian system, mm-hmm. but it had to go through the Renaissance and our bad math and the changing of Julian to Gregorian calendars.
Right.
And so it's all skewed and nobody can agree on when the age of Pisces ends and when the age of Aquarius begins.
Yeah.
But the Maya didn't have that problem because it was their own thing from their culture that they made, and it's not coming from somewhere, and there was no changing of calendars, and they made it.
Right.
And it was based on their own observations over thousands of years, and which were very accurate. They
right.
predicted eclipses into the millennia, like forward and backwards, like insane. They were badass.
They were time and astronomy obsessed.
Yes.
And why?
Because I think they understood that there were cycles to some kind of activity. I don't know, but. We don't know because the Spaniards burnt all their stuff up. And there's only one carved thing in stone that remains that refers to the 2012 date. And it involves a deity.
Is that the big calendar that's in the museum in Mexico City?
No, that's the Aztec calendar, which is similar. You know, there's this idea that they never communicated. It's not true. They traded with each other. They were completely... Towards the end, the Maya sort of merged with the Aztec and the Yucatan.
Right.
And some of them are still working their old lunar calendars that are from 2,000 years, you know, 2,600 years now. The same lunar, what's it called? The Zulcan calendar, mm-hmm. which is a lunar calendar, 260-day calendar.
We've got 2 minutes. Can you explain why 2012 would be...
Well, it's only that they were so... accurate, and they're saying that something is going to happen. Obviously, it's going to equate to the beginning of a new era and the end of another one.
And that's specifically stated by the translation of that.
Well, no. This monument at Tortuguero says it's something involving something from the sky, and this deity who is present during creation events, he's there during the creation of this current world, Balan Yakte is the name of the deity, and he's also present during wartime.
Have they been right about anything else on the calendar? Predictable?
Well, like I said, eclipses, thousands of years back and forth.
Okay, but an eclipse is different than the world ending.
Well, what they described the last... interestingly enough, they described that the end of the last age ended with a flood, just like Noah's flood. And it's about the same time as Noah's flood. So that's interesting. So that plays into the global aspect of that myth, that legend of Noah. Is that this is not a local flood. This was a global flood of some kind that might have been precipitated literally by some kind of an asteroid impact. And that you have a guy, Rusty Schweikart at NASA, who's like...
the astronaut.
If we don't get on this, we will have failed as a species. I mean, this is... we're supposed to be better than this, and we have to be able to predict near-Earth object collisions. And there's this one object called Apophis, and that's not for 2012. That would impact... they would know. It's, I think, May 8th, 2036.
Right. Yeah, I've heard about that one.
That it would impact with Earth, and it would take out about a third of the world population at that time.
If it stays on the track that it's...
If it goes through a particular gravitational keyhole, is what, what it's called, on 2029, in its next... because its orbit is different. It's not one of these things like a comet that goes to the Oort cloud and comes or swings around the sun and goes back out. It's actually in a same kind of orbit around the sun as the Earth's orbit.
In the same plane?
Yeah, it's exactly. And so it's resonant. It's geo-resonant, I guess, what they call it. And so because both are elliptical, we're bound to collide at one point.
Right.
So that's... so the next near thing would be 2029, and if it hits this gravitational keyhole, then they will absolutely observe it for the next 8 years as it swings closer and closer and ultimately collides with the Earth. They'll have 8 years to get busy.
Okay, we've run out of time. Can you say something hopeful?
Yeah, I think... well, basically, did anyone see...
yay, we've got the siren. Every show, we must have a siren it's not right in Mysterio. So
well, if anyone sees Avatar, I mean, basically what you see in that movie is somebody going from one reality field and moving into a higher... form of life, you know, going through the eye of Ewa and making a ascending to a higher plane of consciousness and reality. And maybe that's also what we're being presented with, you know. That's just a hopeful thought.
Good. That is a great hopeful thought, because I can't stand James Cameron.
You mean the king of the world? You don't like the king of the world?
I know. Can't stand him.
No.
Well, his personality, I guess. And the fact that that personality can produce a movie that could probably feed the entire world for about a year.
I think, what was it, something like $10 million a second? What is it? How many? It's ridiculous.
It's made $2 billion since its release.
That's
worldwide.
Incredible. Wow. But I mean, even
and
just...
and that sucks, because that means he'll get to make more.
I like that movie.
I have to see it. We were supposed to have it at work, and it didn't come.
It's incredible.
It didn't come out. I mean, it didn't turn out. I saw
the trailer. The trailer sucks.
Yeah, I know. I saw the trailer like 800 times.
The trailer is the worst. It does not do the movie justice at all.
Well, most don't.
Yeah.
Radio Mysterioso. The next show hasn't come in on time or at all in weeks. So I don't know if I'm... because I was stepping on his time, and it was rude. So I usually try to get out of here at 10. So I think that's what we're going to do, because, well, I don't know if you have to wake up, but I got to wake up at 6 o'clock.
No, I don't got it.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Free.
Yeah. Sheikah is free for now. Oh, well, you make your own schedule.
Yeah, right now.
Yeah.
I'm actually quite busy, but...
well, then that means you got to come in again or talk again. When do you leave, possibly? March 15th.
I think by April 15th. Yeah, around then.
Okay, so can you come in again before tax day?
I'll probably have to file for an extension, but yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to file for an extension this year. I've gotten in problems with that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, I filed for extensions in 2006 and 2007, and then I didn't file.
Oh.
So this year they said, hey, you've got some money coming back, but you're not getting any of it until you file for these 2 years. So I filed for them, and as it turns out, I'm getting money back from those too.
Oh, my God.
So if I go from having no job, no money, and scraping to I got to take this money and put it in a house account, pay off my credit card, and buy a new flying wing.
Oh, you poor thing.
Yeah.
Aww.
So that's my hopeful statement for myself. Thanks so much for coming on the show at such short notice.
Oh, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed it.
I had fun. I hope I was entertaining enough.
You were entertaining enough because we kept our audience and increased it by a couple while the show was going on.
Good.
Which is a good sign.
Good.
And when I get this the recording of this from Miles Lewis at Anomaly Radio Network, I will post it. Yes, I know I'm behind. I've got Sesha Ree, Skylar Alfagren, and Don Ecker still sitting on my recorder. And that'll be – so sometime in the next couple of weeks, you guys are all going to get 4 shows in a row, probably within a few days of each other. And then we can be caught up at the RadioMysterioso.com site. And am I here next week? Yes. I don't believe I'm going anywhere next weekend. So we'll be back next week, next Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Thanks for listening. Is there a song that you want to hear?
Play another one from that group.
Oh, okay. I was going to play Que Sera Sera in Chinese.
Oh, yeah. That sounds good. That sounds good.
Let's see. What does this sound like? Oh, it's in pause.
Oh, my God. Awesome. Excellent.
Got a lot of this Chinese cover music stuff.
Awesome.
This is Grace Chang singing Que Sera Sera. Oh, God.
She's over-rolling the R. It's only one roll. But, you know, I can't speak Chinese.
Oh, me either. Oh, wow. I had another one by Grace Chang that just blew me away. It's a swing tune, and it's mostly in Chinese. It's about half an English Chinese. I think it's Grace Chang. Let me see if I can find it. And then whenever he walks in, then we'll...
She has a beautiful voice, though.
She does. She was a singing star, movie and singing star in China in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. This one is I Want You to Be My Baby by Grace Chang, which I think Sheikah will like. Yeah, this is it.
Sort of Ima Sumac-like.
Yeah, sort of. Some of it. Same era.
Doodly doo, rag mama,
and you never would have read it. And if anybody wonders, you can tell them what I said. The only thing I know is that I never can forget you. I've been longing for you, baby, ever since the day I met you. I got you where I want you, and I'm never gonna let you get away from me. Ain't what I tell you, I'm the girl for you, so you better start to face it. If you ever lose my love, you know you never can replace it. I think it's time for you to start giving me some loving, carrying a touch on you that's harder than an oven. It's time for you to give me a little tot of dumb, baby, hold me tight, then do what I tell you. Oh.
I say R.A.
Is doing a mashup live on the air.
R-O-G-G-M-O-P-P Ragmop, doodly doo-doo-doo, Ragmop. I say R-A, R-A-G, R-A-G-G, R-A-G-G-M-O-P-P Ragmop, doodly-doo-doo, Ragmop. Ragmop, doodly doo.
Show.